Revelation chapter 13, verse 11. For just a few moments this afternoon, I am going to ask you to be old-fashioned Bible students and tell me what a piece of Scripture means. We've read these words until we can recite them backwards in our sleep, but do we really know what they mean to Adventists living in a post-September 11 world? Revelation 13, 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. Verse 13, and he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. Two short verses of Scripture. The year is A.D. 95, and John the Revelator, the last of the living apostles, has been exiled to this little crop of rocks which sticks up out of that beautiful cobalt blue Aegean Sea. And one day he walks down to the shoreline and he looks out across the ocean. He looks into the future, far into the future, and he begins to describe what it looks like. He says, someday there will be a beast. And it has some very unique characteristics. Now, I've talked enough. I've got a good Adventist audience out there. Tell me what it means. I beheld another beast coming up from where? Out of what? Out of the earth. Oh, pop quiz, what does that mean? What does the earth symbolize in biblical prophecy? Unpopulated area. We know that water represents people, and so a beast coming up out of the earth represents what? It represents something coming up from an unpopulated area. Now, what is a beast? In Daniel and Revelation, what do beasts symbolize? Powers and kingdoms, exactly. So we have this kingdom arising from an unpopulated portion of the world. It's unique in that sense because all of the beasts which come before it have risen from water. They've risen from places where there's a lot of people. So this beast comes up out of the earth and he has what? He has two horns like a lamb, right? Now, what can you tell me about this beast based on the fact that he had lamb-like horns? Christ-like? Christ-like in the beginning. Certainly. How do we know that? What is unique about lamb-like horns? Let me ask you a question. When is the last time you were skimming through... What's a newspaper around here that everybody reads? The Philadelphia Inquirer. When's the last time you were paging through the Philadelphia Inquirer and you saw at the front of the local section, troop of Boy Scouts attacked by killer lambs? Lambs are very peaceful, aren't they? Lambs do not make war. Their horns are hardly even defensive in nature. They are very, very peaceful creatures. And so we know that we have a peaceful nation arising from an unpopulated area. And what else do we know about this beast? How quickly does it assume a position of world dominance? How quickly does it arise? Well, let me give you two choices. Rapidly or slow as molasses in January? Rapidly. How do we know that? Because if you look at Revelation 11, within two short verses, he's doing great wonders, making fire come down from heaven on the sight of men. In fact, in the next verse, it says he exercises all the power of the first beast before him. Very quick ascension to power. So we are now beginning to compile a list of things which can help us figure out what this beast is. Two horns like a lamb, arises very quickly. Now, what are horns in Bible prophecy? Kingdoms or powers, characteristics. They are what the power of this beast is based on. What do those two horns represent in Revelation 13, 11? Republican and Democrat nation? Any? Secular, civil and religious liberty. Exactly. Two powers which characterize this kingdom, this beast, and make it absolutely unique from every other kingdom that's gone before it. Civil and religious liberty. Very peaceful qualities, and yet something goes horribly, horribly wrong. two horns like a lamb, but that beast does what? Speaks as a dragon. Now let me ask you, what can make a peaceful nation or a peaceful person act or speak like a dragon? Self-defense. What motivates self-defense? Anybody here remember the psychology class, the fight or flight psychological reaction? You can make peaceful people do incredibly courageous things for one reason and one reason alone. That is an ugly four-letter word called fear. You get people scared enough and they are capable of speaking like a dragon. So John, on the island of Patmos, looks forward in time. He foresees this peaceful nation. Clearly describes the United States, and he says it will speak as a dragon. These are the demands which we make on the Taliban, and they are non-negotiable. You will deliver Osama bin Laden, or you will share in his fate. Fear. Fear can make people do things they otherwise would never consider doing. And that is something that Osama bin Laden has recognized. In a statement made before the 11th, bin Laden said, "I tell you, civil and religious liberty in America are dead." He recognizes the threat he is posing to us. What threat is that? I need four volunteers. Or maybe five. How many people out there feel courageous enough to come up here and participate in an experiment where I promise you we won't harm you much? Anybody wanna come up here? Yes, sir. Now, we got some young people around here. Anybody over there interested? All right, we got somebody there. Yes, sir. That's one, two, three. Now, let me get another young person here. We got a... Okay, great. Yes, please. Come up. It's really very simple. All right. One, yes, sir. Come on up. Did I see you put your hand up? Yes. Come on up. Glad. Please, both of you, come on up. We'll go ahead and have five. And then two people over here, and we will go through this delightful experience together. Come on, yep. All right, we have our five people here. Now, great, just I will have you, sir, sit right there, or actually sit here where the audience can see you. Now, you four are going to be promoted. Congratulations, you have passed the academy at Quantico. You are now FBI agents. I have given you a badge and a gun. And more power than, well, we won't talk about that. And you, sir, are a terrorist. I apologize for that, but we'll work this out as quickly as we can. So we have our four federal officers over here, and you know that another September 11 attack is imminent. Somewhere within 24 hours, thousands of Americans are going to die. Now, suppose you have just arrested this man, who is number two in the Al-Qaeda network. He has papers in his possession that proves he knows all about the plan. You even know when the attack is going to occur. You just don't know where or how. All you know is that something awful is about to happen. And so you question the prisoner. And being the unpleasant sort, he doesn't answer your questions. The clock is ticking. 24 hours, 23, 22 and a half. In less than a day, this nation and this world will go through the agony of September 11 all over again. But that guy knows. If he were to talk, you would know how to prevent the attack. You question him again, but he sneers at you and says nothing. What are you going to do? While you think about that, let me propose to you what the people in the Middle Ages did. Now, they were nice sorts who believed that they were entitled to live in a safe society, and so nonconformists were dealt with in a very interesting way. One of those interesting devices was called the Iron Maiden. That was a casket-type box shaped like a human body, the inside of which was filled with metal spikes. The nonconformist, the person who wouldn't talk, was placed into this box, and the lid was closed, and there was a little slit through which they could watch their eyes. And I will leave the rest to your imagination. Another device by which Middle Ages people made folks talk was a sawhorse. You know what that is out here in Pennsylvania, I hope. It was basically a sharpened metal ridge held up by two vertical supports, and it was rigged up just high enough so that your feet didn't quite touch the ground. A person would be placed on this thing, and then weights would be added to their feet until they were literally pulled down on this knife edge, one painful inch at a time. See, and if that didn't work, there was always the fine prospect of being burned at the stake. In the Middle Ages, people played tough. Torture. Throughout most of human history, it has routinely been used against nonconformists to extract cooperation from people whom society fears. And then, along came a document signed one September day in 1787, just a few miles from this spot. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, promote the general welfare, provide for the common defense, and secure to ourselves and to our posterity the blessings of liberty, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution. And almost immediately, after signing that document, these men sat down and they drafted 10 amendments, which were designed to ensure that that sort of thing never would happen again. Amendment number one, Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor, Mr. and Ms. Federal agents, shall cruel and unusual punishment be inflicted. For generations, this Bill of Rights has protected people from what happened in the Inquisition. But suddenly we face terrorism, death from within, and a group of men hiding in the shadows of the very document you are sworn to defend. We've never faced a challenge like this before, and the survival not only of thousands of people, but ultimately of the very nation itself is at stake. And so now you find yourselves as federal officers weighing the equities, this life or those lives. Thousands of them, among whom are women and children. All of them will die if this guy doesn't talk. This, sneering prisoner's rights, or theirs. Rights as basic as sure survival. You put each of these into the pans of justice on those beautiful scales. And now I ask you again, Mr. and Ms. Federal agents, what do you do? Do you torture this man for information, or do you risk the lives of thousands of your neighbors and your friends? And do we have a mic, Alan, that we can get this on tape for the folks out there in television land? All right, here we go. Are we on? All right. Mr. Agent number one, what's your name?
Bob,
all right. Federal agent, special agent Bob, what do you do? You torture the guy or you let him go?
Sodium pentothal.
That doesn't work. You don't have any. It's a very clever answer. Unfortunately, I only give you two alternatives.
Hypnosis.
Well, we have a creative federal agent here, which is good. He has promise in the federal government. Except that he's probably too creative, and that doesn't work. Bureaucracies don't like that. Torture, or...
First of all, am I a Christian in this position?
You are the person you are today. I just made you a federal officer.
I guess if I was a Christian, I wouldn't be a federal officer, but...
At least not an Internal Revenue agent.
I would have to ask my senior agent.
Now you see, this is a wonderful role-playing model for working with the feds. We've seen one man who was too bright about the matter. We've seen another man who passes the buck. Now, senior federal agent, how do we solve the problem?
Torture him?
Torture him, all right. And now we've made you the director of the FBI. What do? You think you torture this guy or you uphold his civil rights?
Torture.
All right. Thank you very much. You can go back to your seats now. What do you think about all this?
It would be unconstitutional.
And pray you're caught in Washington, D.C., because there will be thousands of lawyers who will be banging down your door willing to make that argument for you. Thank you. You may go back to your seat. All right. Two of our people up here said torture. And I am rather sure that if I had pressed the other two, they would have come down on the same side of the fence. And if they did, they would have been in very good company. Let me tell you what a leading constitutional scholar says we ought to do in this situation. You folks ever heard of Alan Dershowitz? The Alan Dershowitz, Harvard law professor, lifelong champion of the Bill of Rights? Well, Professor Dershowitz suggests we ought to institutionalize torture. Dershowitz says in his recent book, Shouting Fire, that we should establish in our legal system something called a torture warrant. The torture warrant would operate like this. If someone reasonably seems to have information which is needed to save thousands of innocent lives, then they would go to a federal judge. The federal officers would go to a judge, explain the necessity of torture, and they would get the court's approval. Then, using sterilized needles, we certainly wouldn't want the poor person to catch infection from this disease, they would insert those sterilized needles under the man's fingernails until he talked. Or, Professor Dershowitz suggests a technique which is regularly employed by our Israeli friends. They put a foul-smelling bag, and Dershowitz doesn't enlighten us on what the bag is soaked in, but some sort of foul-smelling substance is put over the head of the prisoner, and the federal agents play rock music right in the rear until they can't take it anymore and they crack. This, from a man who has spent his entire life as a champion of the Bill of Rights. That gives you, I think, some idea. The responses you heard here and Professor Dershowitz's suggestion gives you some idea of just how serious the problem is that we are facing. Osama bin Laden knowingly has managed to pose the only challenge to the United States he can. You see, you don't attack the United States militarily. Not while we're protected by our two oceans and our 12 carrier battle groups, each one of which can unleash more destructive force than has been seen in the history of war. You don't ever overcome our military. What you do is you take that precious freedom, as old as this country itself, and you abuse it so badly that you force us to reconsider whether that freedom should be granted. Make no mistake about it, my friends, A bunch of goat herders in tents with talcum powder and 34-cent stamps cannot bring the United States to its knees. Only American citizens can do that if we vote without careful thought and consideration to abridge the very liberties we are sending men and women into Afghanistan to protect. That is the challenge Osama bin Laden has posed to us, and so for just a few moments this afternoon, let's talk about the Bill of Rights. Very quick lesson in constitutional history. If I don't make something clear, please ask a question. We're going to have a Q&A session at the close of the presentation, and I would be delighted to take your questions. Now, in an emergency, do nations suspend liberty? Absolutely, of course they do. In this country, during our Civil War, just 2 weeks after Fort Sumter was fired on, President Lincoln sent an order to General Winfield Scott up at Fort McHenry telling him that if Maryland tried to secede from the Union, he was cleared hot to open up with those big 24-pound Dahlgren cannons and begin lobbing ordnance into Maryland cities until they couldn't take it anymore and they came back into the Union. Which is somewhat ironic because Fort McHenry, if any of you remember your history lessons, is where the Star-Spangled Banner was written. Mr. Francis Scott Key, sitting out on a British warship in Boston Harbor, watched all night long as that fort endured British bombardment and pinned into immortality the words which have now become our national anthem. So President Lincoln sends this order to General Winfield Scott at Fort McHenry to bombard Maryland cities if necessary, and he also authorized the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. What is habeas corpus? In Latin, the term is very simple. It means you have the body. And it has been called the most powerful writ in our legal system. It can compel even a powerful federal agency to hand over a prisoner which they are detaining. We still get, I worked on the Court of Appeal out in California, we still regularly get habeas corpus petitions which prisoners can bring if they feel they are either being confined unfairly or if they feel that their rights are being violated in some way. And habeas corpus is the writ by which they can do that. They can bring even powerful federal agencies to account before a court of law. The habeas corpus writ traces all the way back to the Magna Carta. It's very, very foundational to the English Anglo-Saxon American system of justice. And in the Civil War, Lincoln suspended this thing. There was a Southern sympathizer by the name of Merriman. He had been a secessionist drill company officer, the type of guy you really don't want to have running loose. A huge threat to the Union. And so General Winfield Scott scooped this guy up, round up the usual suspects. Mr. Merriman finds himself in the gulag at Fort McHenry. Well, Mr. Merriman, feeling somewhat put out by his rough handling, files a writ of habeas corpus with Chief Justice Taney of the United States Supreme Court. He says, "You can't hold me here." Chief Justice Taney took a look at that and said, "You're absolutely right. You can't do that. When the civil courts are functioning, military tribunals, military justice is improper. Remember that thought." When the federal marshal tried to serve Chief Justice Taney's habeas corpus decision on General Winfield Scott, guess what happened? Winfield Scott said, "I don't know what to do." Sent it all the way down to Washington. President Lincoln took a look at it and said, "Well, the Supreme Court has made their ruling. Now let them enforce it." In so doing, President Lincoln provoked one of the greatest constitutional crises in the history of this country. The Supreme Court could not make their decision stick, and during the Civil War, thousands of Southern sympathizers were detained, held, and tried before military tribunals in a process which one commentator has called one of the lowest points for civil rights in American history. In times of crisis, very important constitutional guarantees can get thrown out the window, even if the Supreme Court says you can't do that. Same thing happened in other times of crisis. World War I, President Woodrow Wilson said that it was illegal to criticize the draft. Imagine that, just 50 years later in the era of Vietnam. Illegal to criticize the draft, and the Supreme Court upheld him. In World War II, there are a couple of cases you should be aware of. One is Korematsu, the United States. The other is Minersville, the Gabaitis. These two cases stand for the proposition that in times of crisis, civil and religious liberty can go right out the window. 1941, Pearl Harbor is attacked by a Japanese armada. The American public responds with anger, with solidarity. Japanese Americans, whose only crime was looking like the enemy, loyal Americans were scooped up in this huge dragnet, sent off to concentration camps, mostly in Arizona, and forced to stay there for the duration of the war. Mr. Korematsu, a Japanese-American, similarly disliking his treatment, like Mr. Merriman, brought an action, took it all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld the detention, saying that it was justified under the circumstances. Minersville v. Gobitis, a bunch of little Mormon school kids, or Jehovah's Witness school kids, excuse me, refused to salute the flag. It was against their religion, and the school expelled them. They said, if you won't salute the flag, you don't have to come to school. They brought an action. The Supreme Court initially agreed with the school district and said that it was their patriotic duty, and the school was justified in expelling these kids. Korematsu, civil liberties out the window in time of crisis. Minersville, religious liberty similarly imperiled. All of which is just sort of a frame for what the real issue is. And that's what's happening today. Historically, you can't always rely on seemingly bedrock constitutional principles such as habeas corpus. Unfortunately, a lot of those principles have been weakened significantly in fairly recent Supreme Court decisions. We're going to talk about five areas in which today I think we see the potential for severe abridgment of our liberties. Those areas are privacy, profiling, military tribunals, the recent Patriot Act, which I'll just describe very briefly for you, and then religious freedom. Point number one, right to privacy. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects shall not be unreasonably infringed. However, terrorism forces us to make a quantum leap and give federal agencies broad new powers, which they heretofore have not had. One example of that is wiretapping. Now, normally, if you get a wiretap, it is limited to one phone line. So if I have my home phone in Virginia and my cell phone, and one of our federal agents believes that I am running an illegal gambling operation, they can get a wiretap for my phone line in Virginia if they can establish probable cause. However, if I'm smart, and most criminals are, they will realize that Mr. Federal Agent cannot get cannot transfer those taps to other phone lines, and so they will conduct various parts of their business on various phone lines. For instance, I may call people and solicit them for booking on my landline. Then I will have them call me on my cell phone and actually place the bet. Without having access to both, you may not have a case. We have just now passed legislation which allows taps of people, not taps of phones. What's the problem with that? The problem is once you have a tap on a person and you're trying to track them down through these various phone numbers they use, it's very easy to accidentally tap a phone line belonging to their neighbor. You know, you think they have, you think that that's their phone line, and in fact it isn't. And you know, query how many of us want the federal government snooping around in our private phone calls. So that is one area in which we have seen rather large expansions of federal power. Magic lantern is an issue that came up a year or two ago. Basically, the FBI with magic lantern inserts a Trojan horse into your computer. Magic lantern will recognize keystrokes before encryption. A lot of drug runners and other various unsavory characters use encrypted software, which is very hard for federal decoders to break and can take quite a bit of time. The FBI came up with this program which they load onto the person's computer. It captures the keystrokes before the software encrypts the input, and they have access to the information. Carnivore, something I'm sure you heard a little bit about a year ago, program that is on federal web pages. Anytime you visit a federal website, it loads a cookie onto your computer system, which will then track your subsequent website use And the next time you log onto the federal website, they will know what places you visited. So, you know, if you, in a fit of patriotism, visit whitehouse.gov, and then your next stop is at footfetish.com, the federal government will have some record of this. That has probably been stopped. Congress got wind of it, was not tremendously thrilled, probably because they were worried about their own emails being intercepted, or their own website usage. And as far as we know, that's been stopped. But the technology and the capability is certainly there. It reminds me of something Teddy Roosevelt once said, that when they call roll in the Senate, the senators are never sure whether to answer present or not guilty. One other thing that you should be aware of under the Fourth Amendment are the new airport screening devices. We've got a lot of new experimental technology designed to make our air travel safer. This one in particular is quite a joy for those who use it because it's literally capable of seeing through people's clothes. The models which demonstrated the device in a promotional video had to wear a special underwear so as to avoid displaying their inadequacies to the world. Airport screening devices, very, very intrusive, potentially vital to our transportation system and to keeping that safe, especially with the presence of non-ferrous metal and plastic knives, which can be gotten past current security systems. So this is something we may have to do, but it may create a new market in special underwear in the next few years. Huge potential abridgments of our Fourth Amendment rights. And something else that you should be aware of, and we'll talk a little bit more about it when we get down to the Religious Freedom Restoration, or the Patriot Act, is the potential for federal agencies to share the information they have about you. And once again, huge potential abridgment of your Fourth Amendment rights. Let's talk a little bit about profiling. Normally, this has been anathema in America. You will find any number of constitutional scholars who are willing to tell you that it is an outrage, and it is. We are not, at this point, doing active racial profiling. We are, however, doing the new, kinder, safer, gentler, politically correct, national origin profiling. National origin profiling seeks to distinguish between real threats to the country, such as a young man looking like Richard Pryor, very recently out of, say, Syria, and with a very thick-soled shoe on his foot. The national origin profiling would pick out someone who was recently out of the Middle East, whereas it would not select a person who was of Syrian descent but had been a United States citizen or in the U.S. on visa for some length of time. That is supposedly some guarantee that we aren't doing just straight racial profiling. And the real question, I think, becomes, is it possible from a law enforcement standpoint to combat terrorism without doing some type of profiling? The figures are something like this. There are, in this country, at this time, roughly 6,000 Middle Eastern men between the ages of 18 and 35. That's your enemy. Those are the people that flew aircraft into the World Trade Centers, into the Pentagon. Very, very small sub-segment of the population. Okay, very identifiable enemy. If you're going to wage war, if you are going to stop this from happening, these are the guys you need to be looking at, because never forget, 100% of the 19 people that gave their lives to take life were within this profile. So this is something that may be absolutely necessary to do. In fact, it's probably illogical to not recognize this profile. But notice something else about it. It's a religious profile. 18 to 35, Muslim males. Now, does that ring any bells for an Adventist audience? We are now actively profiling people based on religious persuasion. What does Revelation 13 say? At the end of time, he had power to give life to the image of the beast, so that as many would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. A religious profile of people who do not worship in accordance with the majority view. We are seeing a dry run for what Revelation predicted. Now, I don't mean that to say that we shouldn't protect ourselves from murdering terrorists. But notice how the devil is cleverly programming the world mind to adopt the very measures Revelation says will be directed against God's people at the end of time. Okay, let's move through our remaining material very quickly. Let's talk briefly about the military tribunals. A few key features of this thing you ought to be aware of. Basically, what we have done is to create an alternative system of justice. You have the civil, the federal courts, which is where the young Taliban John Walker Lind is being tried. But alongside and parallel to that, you have military tribunals created to deal with quote-unquote terrorists, all of which is fine so long as they are not extended to other segments of the population. What are some characteristics of the military tribunals? For one, you have a secret trial. There is no access of the press. There is no ability for public review of what goes on there. It is a secret trial. Secondly, you have no right of appeal. So that if you are convicted, you don't have the right to appeal to another court and say they got it wrong. The jury of your peers will be six military officers. Now, I have no sympathy for terrorists whatsoever, but I can imagine that if I looked something like Richard Pryor, the last people in the world I would want judging my case would be six line officers who very well might have had friends die at the Pentagon. Okay? Not what you would call a fair and impartial jury. Military officer jury, secret trial, no right of appeal, and it's not a unanimous jury system. Two-thirds can convict in this system. What that means is that a good defense lawyer charged with getting you acquitted may not have the ability to block your conviction by arguing to those one or two minds on the jury which you look at and you know are receptive to your case. I had the privilege of hearing F. Lee Bailey speak once, famous trial lawyer. He said, in comparing the two-thirds majority verdict system to our unanimous system, he said, "Don't take away from me the one weapon I have which might save your life." Very powerful weapon for the defendant, unanimous, the requirement of a unanimous verdict. Military tribunal takes that away. Lastly, this thing that we've created has the ability to impose the death penalty on two-thirds conviction with no right of appeal, no right of public review, and on the word of military officers who may be very unsympathetic to what you have to say. Two more points, let's cover them quickly. Let's talk about the Patriot Act. You've heard a lot about this thing. I will just talk about four points which I think are worthy of consideration and in which we can draw from it. The Patriot Act, as you know, recently passed in response to the terrorist acts, giving quite expanded powers to the federal government. Four or five short examples of that. Number one, immigration. Immigrants to this country, under the Patriot Act, may now be deported if they have any association with a terrorist organization. All of which sounds fine until you remember that apartheid was considered to be a terrorist organization in this country until they succeeded in ending the discrimination. So Terrorist organizations, it's a very loose term. It's capable of a lot of different interpretations. And if an immigrant is found to be associated with a terrorist organization, it's automatic deportation with no right of appeal or hearing. Point number two, sneak and peek warrants. This is something whereby federal officers who are investigating a case but don't want the person they are investigating to know what they're doing can go in secretly. They can put a secret tap in, they can secretly invade their home, take papers out and leave, and hope that the drug lord or whoever, the bad guy, doesn't get wind of what they're doing. Normally, these require showing of cause under Title VII, or called a Title VII wiretap. Under the new Patriot Act legislation, sneak and peek warrants can be obtained only on a showing that the investigation is in jeopardy. This applies to everybody. This applies to you, to me. If you are being investigated by the federal government, this is not limited to terrorists. If you're being investigated by the federal government on a showing that their investigation is in jeopardy, without this thing, a federal officer can obtain a sneak and peek warrant and go into your home without your knowledge and filch through your personal belongings. Point number three, the federal Intelligence Securities Act. This thing is designed to protect us from foreign spies. It's now been expanded by the Patriot Act so that anyone can be searched without a showing of probable cause if they are found to be an agent of a foreign government or a foreign organization. Taken to its extreme, this thing could allow people, if you were associated, say, with Amnesty International, this could allow the federal government to search your home without showing probable cause. Probably won't be taken that far, but that's an extreme example of where the rather ambiguous language could take us. Any association with foreign governments is now sufficient to avoid the probable cause requirement, which is the real teeth behind the guarantees of the Fourth Amendment. Point number four, attorney-client privilege, and this chalk is not cooperating. One of the great Anglo-Saxon guarantees of constitutional rights. Without this thing, none of your other constitutional rights are worth a hill of beans, because the Bill of Rights is now so complicated by case decisions, by the Supreme Court's interpretation, it honestly takes a team of lawyers to decipher what your exact protections are. If you don't have fair and free access to an attorney, you don't have constitutional rights. The federal government is now intercepting attorney-client communications coming from the prisoners out of Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, on the theory that the prisoners may be planning further terrorist attacks. The attorney-client privilege very much under attack in the current DOJ. Something you should be watching for, because this is something that affects all of us. Without that, the whole ball of wax comes down. Lastly, I promise to just very briefly mention info sharing. This is something which has been mentioned by both Deputy Attorney General Mike Chertoff, who is in charge of the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice, and Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, in charge of the Counterterrorism Department. At the division, at the Criminal Department of Justice, Criminal Division, both of these guys have said the most powerful weapon we have now is info sharing. Previous to the 11th, federal agencies were like a pack of junkyard dogs. You know, they hated each other. And so the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms might have some record of your firearms ownership, for instance. Department of Justice might have some criminal proceedings that have been brought against you. FBI might have a background file. All of these pieces of information were not shared among the federal agencies. That has now radically changed. Walls have come down. The agencies are talking to each other. They're cooperating. And they are working on compiling a central database of information on every person, where they now, everyone inputs what they know about you, and they can begin to compile a profile. Very intrusive stuff. Ultimately can lead to something like this. This is a smart card. You've undoubtedly heard of them. It's capable of storing about 60 pages of information on your life. And if the federal government ever succeeds in putting that database together, Literally everything about you could be stored on this card. Without this card, you would not exist. It causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark that they might not, what, buy or sell. You take this thing away, you cease to be a United States citizen. The Canadians have already done it. It's called the Maple Leaf Card. It's designed to combat terrorism. It could be coming south in the next few years. Okay. So we've talked about invasions of privacy, things like the airport screening devices. We've talked about national origin profiling, the military tribunal, some of the erosion of substantive protections there. Talked briefly about the Patriot Act. Let's conclude by talking about what we're all really interested in, and that is religious freedom. What is the level of protection that free exercise of religion has in this country today? And the answer is not nearly as much as it used to. A very brief history lesson for you in constitutional law. Many years ago, back in the 1950s, there was an Adventist gal by the name of Adele Sherbert. She was fired from her job because she would not work on Sabbath. Sounds familiar? I mean, has anybody here had that experience? She's fired from her job. She applies to the State Unemployment Commission. She says, I was terminated without cause. I want unemployment benefits. The Unemployment Commission, by a lovely gentleman named Werner, said, no, you can't have that. We will not give you unemployment compensation because you were terminated for cause. You were terminated because you wouldn't work on your day of rest. Well, Ms. Sherbert did a very smart thing. She got in the phone book and she found a lawyer. And she took the case all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, you can't do this. There is a wall of separation between church and state. They put into history a very hard test for the state to pass. They had to show a compelling state interest in order to discriminate against someone like Ms. Sherbert, who did not attend church on the same day as everybody else. Compelling state interest. That was black letter American constitutional law for a number of years, although somewhat criticized by some constitutional scholars. And another case came along. A couple of American Indian guys this time, Mr. Galen Black and Mr. Alfred Smith. Now, they were drug counselors for the state. They counseled prison inmates on drug use. And part of their religion, they were both American Indians, and part of their religion, a large part of their religion, involves seeing visions. They will, go off into the forest and starve themselves for several days and chew a little bit of peyote, which is a psychoactive substance, and then God will give them a vision and they come back refreshed, and that's the way it works. Mr. Smith, Mr. Black go off for a weekend retreat. They have their religious experience. They chew some peyote. Hopefully they saw some visions. And they came back into work on Monday morning, and the boss said, guess what, guys? It's your lucky day. You're going to get randomly drug screened. They failed. Mr. Smith and Mr. Black, remember, they're drug counselors, were fired. They did not pass go, and they did not collect $200. And they, in fact, they tried to collect $200 from the unemployment division of the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon, when they stopped laughing, said, no, you can't have it. Mr. Smith and Mr. Black, being rather outraged at that treatment, did a very smart thing. They called a lawyer. And the lawyer said, you've got nothing to worry about because there's this case called Sherbert v. Werner. They took the case all the way to the Supreme Court, and Justice Scalia, writing for a majority, said, Sherbert got it wrong. There is no compelling state interest so long as the state can show any non-discriminatory justification for not giving these guys employment benefits. So long as there's any state interest that can be showed, any colorable state interest, the state can do that. Okay? Huge erosion of the protections that you historically rely on as Seventh-day Adventists, especially in employment cases. Sherbert, compelling state interest. Smith overrules Sherbert and says, no, they got it wrong. Any finding of state interest, any colorable showing, will support this type of discrimination. And then, a few years later, on another angle of the wall of separation between church and state, there was another case. And before we get there, let me just tell you what happened with this thing. Congress took a look at this case. They said, you can't do that. We are outraged. And so Congress, feeling very righteous, passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which purported to overrule Smith. Now, unfortunately, Congress does not have the power to do that. In very, very ancient Supreme Court precedent, Congress cannot overrule the Supreme Court when they are deciding what the Constitution says. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1995 was on the books for a couple of years. Case was brought under that, City of Bernay v. Flores, where a church tried to challenge a discriminatory zoning restriction by the city. The Supreme Court said, Congress, you're all wet. We say what the Constitution is. Justice O'Connor, writing for the court, says you've crossed the line. You can't do that. Religious Freedom Restoration Act is unconstitutional. We are right back to Smith. Okay? This is the law right now. A few years later, in an attempt to get federal money, and this is another angle of the wall of separation between church and state. This deals with the ability of the state to interfere in your personal life. There's also an institutional wall between the state and religious institutions. That's what this case is about that I'm going to tell you. There's an old case which says that the standard for interference with a religious institution is that it cannot be pervasively sectarian. Okay? The idea is if the school is pervasively sectarian, the government cannot fund it because that would be too much of a mixture between church and state. Are you following me? Is this making sense? Okay. A small sectarian or presumably sectarian school in Maryland, religious college, decided to challenge this piece of what they, I'm sure, considered idiotic legislation or idiotic Supreme Court precedent. And so they brought a case. And they said, we are not pervasively sectarian, even though we require our students to go to church on Friday night and Saturday mornings. And we do discriminate a little bit in our hiring towards people that are members of our church. But, you know, we're not pervasively sectarian. Yeah, we do have a theology department on campus, but you don't have to worry about that. They make this argument. The district court laughs them out the doors. They say, you are pervasively sectarian. Don't try to tell me otherwise. Columbia Union College, being rather upset with that result, appealed to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit said, no, you're right. The district court is wrong. You are not pervasively sectarian. The state appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which declined to take the case, but Justice Thomas, the great writer, the very sharp right edge of the current Supreme Court, writes a dissent from the grant of cert. He says, from the denial of cert, he says the pervasively sectarian test is wrong. It should be abandoned. It should be overruled. Very persuasive, about page and a half dissent from the denial of certiorari. Goes back down to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit follows his lead, uses his logic, underrules the United States Supreme Court, says the test is wrong, and holds CUC to be entitled to federal money. Okay? You might not have heard about this case, but it is now precedent in the line of cases which, sadly, are eroding the wall of separation between church and state. Two levels to think of this. One is the Sherbert Smith Bernie line of cases which deal with state intrusion into your religious life and into your ability to practice religion. The other is the CUC case, which is symptomatic of a movement in this country's courts to get the state much more involved in your religious institutions. And ladies and gentlemen, I am very sad to have to tell you that it is an Adventist school which will now be the case name cited in support of that proposition. Okay, Columbia Union College v. Clark, low water mark of the wall of separation between government and religion and religious institutions. So where does this leave us? Let's go back to the Word. As we close, let's open our Bibles back to Revelation 13. That little piece of Scripture we just did some exegesis on, and let's ask ourselves, can we begin to see, both in this country's jurisprudence, in the weakening of the wall of separation, and the erosion of substantive constitutional protections such as the Fourth Amendment, the right to counsel, the attorney-client privilege, can we begin to see the mechanism by which an event such as the 11th that compels fear in our neighbors could lead this great nation to an absolute 180-degree turn where we find ourselves, a peaceful nation founded on civil and religious liberty, suddenly speaking as a dragon? And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. Now let me summarize. I don't think we're there yet. This is still a great nation. There is an awful lot of what in the law we call institutional friction between what we see in the lessening of a doctrinal standard and the actual willingness of our neighbors and of the very fine people at DOJ and on the Supreme Court to abridge protections, at least as regards us. I mean, I think there's still an enormous amount of good faith out there, and that's certainly something that we can't underestimate. But at the same time, don't kid yourselves into thinking that the clear black-letter doctrinal standards which formerly protected you are still there. They're not. What you're relying on now is the goodwill of your friends and neighbors. As we have seen, Minersville, the Merriman case, the Southern Sympathizer, certainly Korematsu, when people get scared, when your neighbors look at the world around them and they get scared, the first thing that goes out the window is liberty. If you're perceived as a threat, if you're a minority and you're perceived as a threat, unless you have black-letter constitutional protections, you don't have protection. Goodwill is a very dangerous thing to rely on, and I often quote the letter to the editor, which one man wrote after Oklahoma City. He said, "We've already lost the greatest freedom, and that is freedom from fear." You get people scared enough, and they will willingly take your rights away, and there is far less of a doctrinal wall between a temporary frightened majority and the minority. That's the point we need to take away from this presentation this afternoon. At the same time, we can never forget that the Lord is in control. We are seeing things shape up exactly as Bible prophecy said it would. While we have a right to be concerned about this as Americans, and we should be, we can look at these things with an overwhelming sense of assurance and hope, because we know that the King is there, He's coming soon. And I think as we see these pieces begin to fall into place, they should be a huge encouragement to all of us that the end is very near. A great terror is soon to come upon human beings. We who know the truth should be preparing for what is soon to break upon the world as an overwhelming surprise. I am more than happy to take questions. I think we have a microphone here. I recognize we've moved through an awful lot of material. I can't keep track of this stuff. I certainly wouldn't expect that you could on a very short and an abbreviated presentation. But if there's anything that I haven't made clear, if there's something you'd like me to go back and cover, be glad to. How many were at the meeting Friday evening? Okay, a large majority of you then understand some of the potential challenges which are waiting out there to introduce, or which could introduce, that fear element which very quickly overcomes even black-letter constitutional protections. But if there's any questions about that, you want to talk about Israel, more than glad to take those questions. Yes, sir, do we have a mic for him? Good, all right, 1 second, we'll get you a microphone so we can have this on tape.
We're always under the understanding that the Supreme Court is our final say. I understand or have heard now that the UN is even over the Supreme Courts of different nations. You familiar with anything about that?
That is what you're basically talking about are two parallel systems of law. Let me get myself some space on the blackboard here so I can diagram some stuff in response to questions. The international, what you're of course speaking about, some of the Hague Accords, the international courts which are now being convened to deal with things like war crimes. In this narrow sense, pursuant to treaties, treaties are considered to be coextensive with the Constitution. So if we were to sign a treaty with England, that treaty would be entitled to the same deference as the Constitution. Query, can that be used to overcome constitutional protections? Probably not. I mean, that's an interesting area of debate that you bring up, and it traces all the way back to a gentleman by the name of McCulloch, who had his home taken away by the British. He was a British a citizen who had his home taken away by the Americans, and he sought to get it back, and the issue there was interpretation of the treaty. The simple answer is no. The UN is not over the United States Supreme Court. Each sovereign nation in any type of treaty still retains their court systems, and to the extent that a treaty conflicts with the Constitution, it would probably be interpreted in such a way that it doesn't conflict with our Constitution, which, believe it or not, lawyers are sometimes capable of doing. The simple answer is that our Supreme Court is very much functional. It's not subordinate to any nation's court. In international issues, we may find, as to international transactions and that sort of thing, that international law governs. But that is a business transaction. That has absolutely nothing to do with your substantive constitutional protection. So it's a good question, but the Constitution and the Supreme Court are still very much present, an international court would not be able to overrule something the United States Supreme Court said. Do you want to add anything to that? Okay. Yes, sir. And thank you very much, by the way. You made an excellent terrorist.
Thank you. Yes, a question concerning, I guess, Israel, where we're headed today with this thing over there. What the speculation is, what's going to turn out of this. I did hear Thursday night something interesting. The mayor of Bethlehem was calling for the Pope to come over and help, institute a peace plan.
That I had not heard. The mayor of Bethlehem was calling for that. I have a hard time seeing the Holy Father tottering into Bethlehem.
Absolutely, this was on MSNBC.
I've been studying for finals this week, so my awareness of world events has plummeted. If it has anything to do with Federal Rule of Evidence 803, I can answer your question no problem. The real issue that you're identifying as to the future in Israel, let me answer sort of the broader question, and then we'll get to the potential for the Pope to do anything to resolve this mess. Let's just talk very briefly about Israel. I mean, I'm a horrible artist, but here we have Israel. Take my word for it. That's it. Egypt extends down here to the south. You have Jordan to the east. Syria sticks a little corner of itself down here. And then Lebanon, of course, up to the north. Israel, as you know, is surrounded by enemies, and of course, the Red Sea on the west coast. The situation now is extremely confused. You have Israeli incursions into Palestinian refugee camps. A little bit of historical history on that. 1998, Yasser Arafat received about 95% of what he wanted. Deal which he was offered was extremely attractive. He threw a temper tantrum and wouldn't take it. He turned it down and instituted this reign of terror, the suicide bombings, or was at least complicit in doing that. And I think the real problem now is that Arafat has turned loose something that he can no longer call back. There has been so much bloodshed at this point that I don't honestly, in secular terms, see a way of negotiating out of this. Given the mindset in the region, the idea that every person which is killed thereby lays on their family a burden to avenge their death, there have been so many deaths now, there's so much bloodshed, that there are just too many people out there angry and willing to strike back at Israel. I think we really see ourselves in a situation where the terminal end game is absolute victory for one side or the other. And I really think that's what we see Mr. Sharon trying to achieve. By pushing tanks into West Bank towns, my feeling is he's trying to make life so wretchedly miserable for the Palestinians that they just simply decide to get up and leave, moving into Jordan as they did back in 48, certainly some into Syria and into the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. So, in secular terms, the situation there is very bad. Let's talk briefly about the countries surrounding Israel. Egypt has actually said, the Prime Minister has said, we consider this to be an act of war. Egypt has not yet mobilized troops. It could at any time, and if it did, Israel would, in all probability, launch a preemptive strike, as they did in 1967. Syria, of course, to the north, I don't think even they know what they're going to do next. Very unstable regime. And then, never forget, floating around here off to the northeast are our old friends Iraq and Iran. At this point, Israel has certainly the balance of power in the Middle East. They have the finest small military in the region. Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Iran are relying on aging Soviet bloc equipment. Probably not well maintained. The troop morale is not that good. Israel can take care of itself unless one of these nations gets their hands on a nuclear bomb. Then they have parity, then they can hold Israel and, in fact, the West hostage. Back in 1992, intelligence sources believed that nuclear weapons had leaked out of the former Soviet Union, one of the Stan countries, came down an ancient smuggler route, down through the Ural Mountains and finally wound up here in Iran. We now believe four of those warheads are in Iran. Two are thought to potentially be in Syria. One of them, to the best of our knowledge, is hung on the wing of a MiG-27 fighter bomber at Shiraz Air Force Base. That gives Iran a regional area coverage, which includes most of Israel and certainly the Persian Gulf. Our carrier battle groups there now certainly have to contend with the possibility of preemptive nuclear attack by the Iranians. They have to consider that as a threat. And guaranteeing the safety not only of Israel but of our forces in the Gulf has just gotten a lot more complicated. If this thing goes up, and it could at any moment, we could see a type of war that we really haven't witnessed in 50 years. There's a lot of hatred in the region. There are a lot of countries here that would love to see Israel get wiped off the map. And, you know, certainly any exchange of some type of weapon of mass destruction, nuclear, biological, or chemical, would draw our Navy into the Persian Gulf where it could potentially be subject to WMD attacks. So it's an interesting situation. I mean, at this point, it's basically day-to-day. You define victory for Israel at this point as the absence of terrorist bombings, which they have been fairly successful in achieving. So, you know, with any luck, we'll see them pull out of the West Bank towns after they finish this campaign, and things will resume some semblance of normalcy. But the potential for things to go wrong is very, very large. Okay, one more question, and then we'll give you a little break, and we'll move on. Maybe a couple more. Yes, sir.
Our constitutional guarantees have generally been extended to all peoples in this country. Mm-hmm. Do you see any possibility that in the future those could be limited to just citizens?
It's a very interesting argument. I mean, I think the Constitution is unclear as to whether its protections extend to non-Americans within our borders. And certainly, to the extent you want to find a principled distinction for treating non-American terrorists in some different manner from which we treat our own citizens, that would be it, that the protections of the Constitution simply don't extend to people who aren't Americans. You know, however, if we do that, we're really selling our own heritage as a nation sadly short. And we're a nation of immigrants. All of us at one time or the other traces roots back to people who came to this country and found the promise of a new life and a new opportunity here. And to begin to try to split hairs as to whether the Constitution protects those who have attained U.S. citizenship or not is, I think, certainly doctrinally unwise and as a matter of constitutional theory really belies the very spirit in which that magnificent document was written. I mean, the Declaration of Independence, I think, was very clear. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. You know, this country was founded on the principle that everybody who wanted to come here would be entitled to the same protections that we have as American citizens. And I think you raise an excellent point, but hopefully that would not be a distinction we would care to draw. Yes, sir, one more question.
We hear a lot of debate today on, and actually it seems like the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are being presented as antagonistic toward each other. For example, you hear a lot of talk, my free exercise includes the right to use government as a means of propagating my religion. And any denial of that would be a denial of my free exercise rights. So I was wondering if you had any insight on that.
Go back to the basic language of the Constitution. Government shall make no law prohibiting the establishment of religion, regarding the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. This is a classic example of statutory construction. You basically have the Establishment Clause or prohibiting free exercise. Now, you know, we could certainly go back to the founding fathers, the Federalist Papers, and we could go round and round in circles, as Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas love to do, asking what the founders really meant by this, and how would they have read this back in 1782. I am often reminded of a statement by Thomas Jefferson, written many years later. He was a man who was very much, of course, in favor of rewriting the Constitution frequently. He said, I hear the argument often today that we must not mess with the Constitution, and I'm paraphrasing, we must not rewrite the Constitution because it is somehow sacred or the men who wrote it were wiser than those of today. He said, I knew that era well. The men of that day were very much like the men of this day, except perhaps without the benefit of experience which we have today. Certainly, I think we have to look at this in light of modern experience. And what you're basically proposing is to make the Establishment Clause antithetical to the free exercise in the sense that you can't establish a state religion, but free exercise of religion demands the use of the state vehicle. For that, let me ask you a question, if I may. Is America a Christian nation? How many people say no? How many people say yes? All right. Is America a great nation? What about the atheist? Huh? Is America a wonderful, great nation for them? All right. What about the Buddhist? Prayer in schools, take that as an example. I want to freely exercise my religion in state schools, but there's an establishment clause that says government cannot establish religion. So you establish prayer in schools. Just for a pop poll, how many people would support allowing prayer in schools? Okay. Legislating. What if the prayer that is offered in school is not to God or Jesus, but to Allah or to Buddha? Are those people any less Americans than you or I? Are they any less entitled to the protections of this magnificent document just because they choose to believe differently than us? My friends, the genius of America is in the proposition, I may absolutely disagree with your point of view, but I'll give my life so you can have it. Okay? To make the Establishment Clause contrary to the Free Exercise Clause would be to introduce into the very statutory language an ambiguity and a tension which obviously wasn't there. If these two were meant as antithetical balancing clauses, very likely they would not have been included in the same constitutional provision. Very likely they wouldn't have been put in at all. The Constitution was designed as an outline, if you will, of things, and especially the Bill of Rights, things which the government could not do. They couldn't establish religion. They couldn't prohibit its free exercise. So in dealing with these clauses, you can argue endlessly about how you actually interpret them. I think as a matter of theory, it's safe to say America is a great nation, whether it's a Christian nation or not. It's a great nation for our atheist friends, for our Buddhist friends, and any infringement of that, any establishment of religion, be it Christian or otherwise, which makes the minority feel uncomfortable or somehow disenfranchised, is very much against the spirit of this provision. I would read those co-equally. I would not read a tension into them. And I think the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause are very, very coextensive. One obviously deals with government's intrusion into your religious institutions. The other one, or religion's institution into infiltration into government. The other deals with your personal right to exercise that. I don't see a distinction. All right. Thank you very much. Any questions? I'll be thrilled to answer them. Let's take a 5-minute break and come back at about 3:35. Thank you.
You've been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2002, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. For additional cassettes by this speaker or for a free catalog of other American Cassette Ministry cassettes, please contact us as follows. To order toll-free in the United States and Canada, dial 800-233-4450. For international calls, dial 717-652-7000. For fax orders, dial 717-652-9050. Our internet email address is info@americancassette.org. Other cassettes may also be ordered from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our entire catalog is online, and we accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. Or you may simply write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 920.